Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Touch Arcade Podcast. This is episode 8. I'm Eli, and tonight we have Arnold.
Hey.
Blake.
Hey.
And from Tiger Style Games, we have Randy Smith.
Hello.
And Dave Kalina.
Hello.
So David and Randy, of course, are from Tiger Style, who created Spider, The Secret of Bryce Manor, which was one of our favorite games for 2009. So we figured we'd finally have them on the podcast to learn a little more about them and also talk a little more about Spider. So Randy, David, do you guys want to introduce sort of what the story behind Tiger Style Games was and how, I guess, you came to be creating iPhone games?
Sure. Dave and I used to work together at Ion Storm in Austin, Texas. And that's, at the time it was a studio that was headed up by Warren Spector, who amongst, the PC and console gaming crowds is, considered a game god and stuff. And we worked together on Thief, Deadly Shadows. Mm-hmm. And David also worked extensively on Deus Ex 2, Invisible War. We went our separate ways to different parts of the, console games industry after that studio closed down. And most recently, I was at Electronic Arts in Los Angeles working on a pretty cool project with Steven Spielberg and my game design mentor, Doug Church, and some other folks. And I'm going to sort of like trail off so David can pick it up from here so he can say where he was.
So I was at Midway Games here in Austin. I worked for 3.5 years on a project that got canceled before Midway went bankrupt. So Randy and I both kind of found ourselves out of work around the same time. And Randy approached me about doing something crazy and trying to start a business making games for the iPhone. We were excited about the possibilities. And it was, this was late 2008. So this was maybe a few months after the App Store had opened, and, it was just kind of starting to get a little bit of that gold rush kind of feel where you were hearing stories in the press about people, quitting their day jobs because they had a successful run making an app in their garage or whatever. Mm. So we kind of got together and tried starting to recruit our friends and, people elsewhere in the industry to kind of collaborate with us and work with us. And, eventually we found our way to the concept that became Spider.
Yeah, and Spider finally launched. So you started this all started sort of in late 2008, you said. And then when did Spider finally launch?
Right. So we started working on Spider in earnest in December 2008, okay. And we released into the App Store in early August of this year.
Okay.
And have had a pretty good run with Spider. And we just finished two related projects. We just this week released a free game called Hornet Smash into the App Store.
Sorry, what was that? Hornet Smash?
Yeah, it's called Hornet Smash, mm-hmm. And it's basically a free game. It's like a game mode. If you're familiar with Spider, the main game, it's like an additional game mode, and it has full online leaderboards and all this stuff. It's more of an action arcade game where there are these waves of hornets, and they start building nests, and eventually the nests kind of blow up and spawn these angry hornets into the world, and the angry hornets can sting you. And so you're trying to dodge angry hornets and smash as many hornets as you can and rack up a high score. So we just released that. That came out just 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. And we also released what we call the director's cut version of Spider, The Secret of Bryce Manor, where I guess Randy can talk a little bit more about what's in the update.
Actually, I have a question for you about Hornet Smash. Is it only one level, or am I just really bad at it?
No, there are three levels that you can choose from.
Okay.
In Hornet Smash. And then it also includes a light version of Bryce Manor. So there's one room from the full game.
Eli, you're going to need to die to see the menu about which level you want to play when you start over.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, right. We're really big on trying to get the player right into the game, for both Spider and Hornet Smash. And one of the things we've learned is that the unintended side effect of that is that until you are done the current game, you don't notice that there's other game modes you could play. So,
must have been doing very good then.
Yeah, you must be.
I haven't died awesome. Yet. And I'm like, what's going on? Is this go to another level? What's,
Yeah.
Continue.
Well, I think that was it.
I think you're the director's cut.
Oh, right. And so, the director's cut is what we wanted to be was like a really big, meaty update to Spider. Like, we did release one very minor update right after the game came out, which is like this obscure bug fix. But otherwise, we, you know, unlike a lot of the other companies, released, you know, periodic updates with a little bit of content, and that's cool too. But our approach, we wanted to sort of over deliver and just have one really big update. And we called it the director's cut because it contains about a bunch of material that we, you know, deliberately withheld out of our first release because we didn't feel like it was quite ready. And, you know, we really wanted everything to be very high quality. And in addition, we sort of benefit from the fact that, you know, we've seen how the game was received by the audience. We know what they like and what they don't like and what they understood about the story and what they didn't. So that all kind of worked up into this director's cut as well. It's got some of the features, such as level select, that they really wanted the most. It's got a bunch of new levels which cover aspects of the story, you know, that they were curious about, but sort of in the spirit of the original game. We hope that it, you know, raises as many questions as it answers. It's got a few, you know, additional features like that. So we're pretty excited about it.
So backing up a minute, Eli, yeah. You want to talk about just what Spider is, or what Spider, the Secret of Bryce Manor, was when it came out and sort of the reception?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it seemed like it was one of those games that came out and someone picked it up on our forums and posted about it, and everyone was kind of like, what's the deal with this game? You know, because it looked extraordinarily polished at the time, but no one had heard of it because you guys didn't do any like pregame marketing at all. So it was just released one day and everyone was really confused because it seemed like a really good game. But usually when there's really good games released, you know, you hear about them in development. They, you know, are doing like a semi-public beta and sending out previews and stuff like that. So it came out and everyone was just like, what? So, but maybe that was part of the good thing about it, though, because the whole game's wrapped around this mystery of what's going on inside of Bryce Manor. So I think part of the original draw of the game might have been because no one had any idea, like, what was going on in the game at all. Because you weren't fed information through previews, you know, where it's like, hey, he plays a spider, and, you know, you can either choose to get really involved in the mystery of this mansion or just ignore it entirely while you're spinning webs and all this other stuff. So no one really knew how to handle the game, and I think myself included with that. And it just kind of spiraled into this hugely, sounds like, semi-successful title. Am I right?
Yeah, so, we think it's very successful. We're really happy with the reception, you know.
Well, great. And it just, I mean, it took off, and I thought it was great, and everyone else thought it was great, and it just went on from there.
Yeah, so I think the appeal, so aside from the mystery surrounding the game itself, which... you know, throughout the you do play a spider crawling around this mansion, this deserted mansion, and there's a lot of storyline aspects to it that can be inferred and sort of gotten as you explore. But but that's sort of a background portion of the game. The actual game itself is controlling the spider, spinning webs, and I think the art style was really. Was really nicely done. I think people were, that was one of the big aspects that people really enjoyed. I think the actual game mechanic was also, more or less perfect for the iPhone. You know, playing the spider actually felt like it was, like you had good control over it. The swipe to jump worked really well. And I think, you know, it was just, it ended up being a really fun game, which, I guess original game, you know, it wasn't the usual, I don't know, there's a lot of, you know, cliches or a lot of genres that are just all, you know, the match threes or whatever that you see again and again on the iPhone. And this was just a different game concept. And I think Blake had a comment about, were you talking about the physics of the...
yeah. Well, first I'll say you mentioned the art style. I was, you know, from the very beginning, I was extremely impressed with the art. And was it one of you guys that did that or...
Not at all. Like, actually, by our backgrounds, I'm like a designer with a little bit of programming background. David's a programming and engineer with a really great design instinct, but neither of us has much coverage in the art department. So one of the challenges us in developing Spider was sort of like, creating an art direction, building an art department that could make it. So we really, you know, owe a huge debt of gratitude to our artists, Amanda and Brennan, Katie, Theron, Eben, and who else am I missing, David?
Randio.
Who were the heroes of the look of that game, really.
Well, that's a sizable group you've got there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, that really sets it apart. I mean, it feels kind of like, as far as the mystery aspect, I mean, it feels like, it kind of takes you back to, 19th century sketches somehow. I thought that really was a very nice piece of it. But the point, I think that what Arnold was referencing before we went online was I was saying that I've been playing Spider again here in the past few days, and the physics, I think when you you're crawling around the environment, and when the physics of jumping from place to place and tying your web from point to point, I was very impressed. It feels very realistic or something like that. I mean, it seems like the physics were well done, and that was, maybe that wasn't such an important touch, but it really, it kind of makes a difference. And also, I like the fact that when you're crawling, the spider kind of dodges forward, slows down, like you see a spider actually do when it's crawling around it. I thought that added a lot to it. I wondered if there was, in fact, a lot behind the physics, or if that was just if it looked nice, with a simple implementation, or
well, there are the physical simulation of the game is actually pretty simple, because the world is 2D and there's a collision map, and basically when the spider jumps, we're just applying gravity to it, based on, there's we map a speed onto the vector that you're drawing with your finger. It definitely took a lot of work to really nail the controls down more generally. And I think a lot of the kind of feel of the spider that people are responding to comes from the animation that we got. We had an animator named Jen Cha who did the spider animations. And I think there's just some really good little touches in there, like how the spider lands when it hits a surface. It kind of it transitions into the walk cycle really cleanly, and it kind of gives it this good feel. It was from the very beginning, we wanted to make a game. It was important to us to make a game that was really iPhone native and designed for the platform. So as soon as we had settled on the touch-based mechanics, we really spent a lot of time looking at them in the play test and, watching people play and, just iterating on it over and over again until it really felt right. So we're really glad that people are, responding to it and think that it feels really natural and everything.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems if you were to describe the proposition to someone having not seen the game, it seems like it couldn't help but being a little bit awkward, but I think that there is no awkwardness there. So, I think that's a success in that regard. So,
thanks.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, as a game, as an iPhone game, is successful. And the reason we wanted to mentioned it as one of the best iPhone games in 2009 was because it took advantage of the platform, which I think a lot of games don't always do. And it was an original game. And I think you guys also sort of embody the whole. App Store, the appeal of the App Store, the indie appeal, being able to launch an original title with, I guess you guys are a virtual company with people scattered everywhere, right?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, that sort of indie gaming setup is sort of what people have been saying. The iPhone's been the App Store has been really... it's been possible with the App Store, where maybe not possible in more recent
previously. Yeah. Yeah. Well, the way I like to think about that is, it's like the first congregated platform of legitimacy as an indie developer. Like previously, if you were an indie developer and you wanted to make a game that didn't cost $25 million with a huge team of 100 or 200 people, which is kind of the de facto standard of AAA console development these days, mm-hmm. if you want to do anything smaller than that and actually be competitive and sustainable, there wasn't a clear destination for your game. There's sort of the flash market on PCs, and maybe if you're lucky you could romance Nintendo and be on the DS or something like that, but I think it's just really clear that these days that the iPhone is a great place for that kind of a thing. And I think that, Apple's been, really supportive and really democratic with their platform. And I think, their developer support is actually pretty good, it's easy mm-hmm. to develop for the platform. So TigerStyle was able to get up and running and just start cranking away on real development right away. And there was a ready market for our game that was, ready to find it and respond to it. You know, Apple was helping out with the promotion and so forth. So it's really just kind of a no brainer for us. Like, that's where we wanted to be.
And there are other places that you can like kind of succeed as an independent developer making smaller games than like the really big budget AAA stuff. I mean, Xbox Live Arcade is obviously a really big market for independent gaming now, but there's still a much higher barrier to entry. And I think that the expectation is that there are production values that are, you know, significantly higher than on the iPhone. So really, you know, yeah, like Randy's saying, you know, the barrier to entry was really low for people like us. And we're able to kind of get in and, you know, do a concept that we were really passionate about and do that all out of pocket and not be beholden to, you know, somebody else for funding the project.
Eli, did you have any other questions?
No, not really, unless you just want to. I thought your presentation that you did at GDC was great with how your team is structured and everything. Do you want to just very briefly go over how all that works?
Sure. Basically, Randy and I are the two principals. We co-own TigerStyle, and so we're the two guys who are working full-time for the entire duration of the project. But we have we wouldn't have been able to do Spider without the contributions of our part-time contributors. And some of these people work really hard. Like Amanda Williams has been really working close to full-time for us for a while, and she's been really instrumental in doing you know, most of the art and the update and in other places. But you know, we have we kind of just built this network of people. You know, we found them all through various different places. You know, a lot of we would kind of go to old industry contacts and ask them if they knew people who were looking to do art. The people who contributed all the music to the game are just old friends of Randy's and mine. So, you know, it was kind of this ad hoc process where we were just, you know, looking for people who were willing to contribute without necessarily being able to pay them up front. So we kind of had to sell them on the idea that, hey, we're like, we're a legitimate operation and we're going to make a game and it's going to be really great. So if you contribute, we can promise you a little something on the back end. So I think what's kind of cool and modern about our business is that it's almost like a co-op. You know, if you contribute to a significant degree developing something for our games, we're going to give you like a cut of the profits of the game. You're going to own a little piece of the game that you make. And I think that's kind of a rare deal that you don't really see in the traditional industry. You know, so it's obviously not for everybody. You can't necessarily work for us if you really need that steady paycheck because you have to feed a family or something. So we kind of had to find people who were amenable to the working conditions. But at this point, everybody's really psyched about it because we're making money and people are getting royalties and are going to continue to get royalties as long as Spider sells. So,
yeah, no, it's great that it did so well. And obviously, I don't think you'll have so much trouble finding, you know, people part-time folk at this point going forward. And, you know, being a success, I think it's obviously opens the door for future projects and whatnot. And I guess, are you all working on Title 2 already, or has the update taken up most of your time?
This is where we insert a mysterious and evocative answer. In the past few weeks, we've been really consumed by Hornet Smash and sure. by the director's cut. Prior to that, we throughout the life of Spider, we occasionally were tossing around concepts about what we do next. And in the very near future, we want to turn back to that full time and really start thinking more seriously about it. But, you know, we've had hours and hours of discussion about what game number two might be. And,
sure.
We are not intending to rest on our laurels and assume that whatever we make is going to be good enough. I think part of the magic of Spider was, at least from my point of view, like how terrified I was that it wasn't good enough, you know. And I really hope that, you know, we build on our team chemistry and our good dynamics and everything we've learned in making Spider, but also hold on to the terror that like we have to do the absolute best we possibly can. So we're very early in the process for Game 2, but we really hope that we're going to deliver something that's just as exciting to people.
Yeah, but I mean, the beauty of, I guess, you know, you're going to be a significant advantage this time around having had a successful launch title. And, you know, I think people are going to, you know, when Title 2 does come out, everyone's going to be, you know, I think you'll get a lot of press for being, you know, the title after Spider from TigerStyle.
We hope so. And so, I think a lot of what we're trying to do with, you know, both the Director's Cut and Hornet Smash is sort of like establish a trend of exceeding expectations and over-delivering, you know. Mm-hmm. We hope that eventually people will just be able to buy Tiger Style games as soon as they come out without having to hear anything beyond just that name, you know, like some of my favorite bands or movies or directors or whatever, I have that same attitude, you know. So.
Right. No, exactly. And I think that's, you know, I mean, you know, you hear a lot of the downside of the App Store you always hear about is sort of the difficulty in rising above the noise. But clearly building a brand is, as you guys are, is going to be key to, you know, that to making that not a non-issue for you all.
That's our hope. That's our ambition.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. Was there anything anyone else wanted to say about Tiger Style or Spider?
Well, you have tons of fans that love Spider, so I'm sure there's people out there that are wondering if you guys ever plan on turning it into a game series where there might be a sequel someday, or if that's off the table, or
this
not
is where
sure
we
yet.
Inserted mysterious and evocative answer.
you know, I would love to revisit Spider. I think there's a ton of great material to explore, you know, that we've only really scratched the surface of. So, you know, it's in discussion for next project, but I think Randy and I both have this, like, this attitude of really wanting to strike out and do something different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's balanced a little bit by this fear that, you know, the App Store moves so quickly, if we wait too long to make Spider 2, people are going to forget what Spider is or something. But I think at some point we'll come back to Spider. We just don't know when that will be.
Excellent.
Okay. Sounds good. Moving on, I think we're going to structure this podcast a little differently. Normally, we go over a few games that have come out recently and have had everyone played them. But this time around, since this is our end-of-year, best-of sort of roundup, we actually had everyone pick two games that they were amongst their favorite iPhone games of 2009. And we're just going to go down the list and have the person who picked it talk about the game a little, and the rest of us will chime in as to, you know, whether we agree or disagree or whatnot.
Should probably add in that this was very hard to choose two. I think everyone started with a list of like 20.
right. The original list everyone submitted were like 20 games long, so it forced everyone to cut it down to two, just so we wouldn't go, you know, 8 hours on the podcast. So David's going to start it off with the two games that he can just start with the first one, and then we'll talk about it. So, David, can you just say the name of the game and sort of a brief description of the game in case no one's played it, and then why you loved it?
Sure. Well, so my personal favorite iPhone game of the year was Zen Bound by Secret Exit. And if you're not familiar with Zen Bound, it's a kind of unusual game where you are basically tasked with wrapping a wooden statue in rope. And I think for me, you know, I kind of like non-traditional game concepts, but what really was so enjoyable about Zen Bound was how tactile it was. You know, like you really feel like you're manipulating this 3D object. A lot of the times on the iPhone, I feel like people are making 3D games just because they can, not because it's necessarily appropriate for the platform. Which is also an interesting part of Zen Bound's history, is that it didn't really start as an iPhone game. It started as a PC game. But it seems like it was designed for the iPhone because it just kind of really perfectly works with the touchscreen and the accelerometer and just feels very natural. And it's got a very beautiful vibe. Like, the graphics are really strong. It has a, you know, really incredible soundtrack, and, you know, you can really just kind of get immersed in this task of wrapping these statues. I think I also just like it because it's got a kind of meditative vibe, and you know, there's so many action arcade adventure games out there, and so many games on the iPhone are kind of just, you know, riffing off of established genre conventions. For me, this was kind of a breath of fresh air, and it demonstrated that you can kind of succeed on the iPhone doing things that are a little bit non-traditional and risky.
No, I agree. I'm surprised. I was surprised how well Zen Bound did, considering all things considered.
Yeah, it got into the top 10 at one point.
Yeah, it shot up really quickly.
And that was at $5.
How high did it go, Arnold?
I don't have it offhand, but it was definitely in the top.
It was in the top 5, wasn't it?
It may have been, yeah.
The soundtrack is phenomenal. I mean, can you still download it for free, or was that just a promotion they did for a while? Anyone know?
I think you can, but
I don't recall. What were you saying, Arnold?
Oh, Blake, I know you really liked the game as well.
Yeah, no, you know, it was just, I think it was one of the first iPhone games that, when you would, as you said, manipulating the 3D object, I mean, it really felt like you were manipulating that thing in real space. And that was something, I mean, the subtleties that went into making that happen, you know, are beyond what you, you know, can typically imagine sitting here as a player. I also appreciated the fact that, you know, graphically, yeah, obviously there were, you know, not a very high polygon count on the game, but, you know, there were different levels of texture filtering, you know, as you went, as the depth, you know, when the object went back into the rear area of its rendering field. And just a lot of these subtle touches. And I think Arnold and I talked about the fact that these guys came from the demo scene. Am I not correct, Arnold?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, and so, you know, they were no strangers to kind of pushing hardware to the limits as far as, you know, really getting some impressive results out. And you know, Zenbound just has a polish and a feel. And the music is no small part of it. I mean, it is just wholly impressive. I've actually, you know, I've referred, you know, before to the fact that I gave my, you know, I gifted my sister with an iPod Touch. She's a mobile game. She loves the mobile games, and the first game that I pointed her to was in fact Zenbound, you know, as someone coming into the platform anew, and it seems not, you know, that seems kind of an obvious choice for someone to just, you know, kind of get wowed by the iPhone, or the iPod Touch.
The thing about Zenbound is you want to say that it's a game that wouldn't have been existed if not for the iPhone, though it's ironic because it did exist for the PC, but I don't know if it worked for the PC.
Well, apparently I've heard many reader comments that it did not compare on the PC to the iPhone implementation.
Yeah, no, I think so. It really shined with the iPhone.
Right. I mean, if you imagine, you can kind of picture how it would work with the mouse, but it's just not the same.
Randy, did you have anything to add?
You know, I think you guys have covered it. It's a very fresh, very stylish game, and I think it's so great that part of the concept is to have this meditative experience. You know, games are always supposed to be so urgent and frantic, and it's nice when games break that mold. And so I thought that was a wonderful, like, type of emotional spectrum to target.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, game number two, pick number two.
All right, so my second pick is a little bit more traditional in the space. I went with GeoDefense and GeoDefense Swarm as my kind of second favorite iPhone games of the year. And, you know, I really I hadn't been exposed to the tower defense genre really prior to the iPhone. And a lot of tower defense games kind of leave me cold. And I think there's something about GeoDefense that I find really appealing in its purity. Like, I love its abstraction. I really like the way it looks. It just feels very right to me as an iPhone game. I love the fact that the entire world is, like, visible at all times, and you know, the particle effects really kind of add a lot. But ultimately, tower defense games are kind of about the challenge. And I'm not such a hardcore player that I could get to the upper ranges of difficulty on these games, which are apparently really brutal. But it was really one of the only games that kind of had me coming back for more, where I would, you know, I would lose and I would feel very conscious of the things that I did wrong when I was trying to, like, lay out a field and, you know, place my units in the right places. You know, so it was just kind of a game that very immediately rewarded kind of going back and trying to master it. And I also just kind of thought it had a cool style, and you know, just I think they did a really good job. So, GeoDefense, awesome.
Randy, did you have any thoughts about GeoDefense?
I didn't play it a whole lot. I thought it was a very well-tuned, you know, tower defense game. But if there's never another tower defense game made again on any platform ever, it'd be okay.
Yeah, you know, I just a comment about the abstraction. Like, you know, I played other games like, you know, Star Defense, and I found that just, like, the whole 3D planet thing was really distracting. You know, like, I didn't feel like that was adding a lot to the core experience. Like, I like the fact that GeoDefense is kind of no frills in this way. Like, it just gets right to the point. You know,
Eli.
Well, the thing that I like about the game is that it was so difficult. The first one, anyway, was so difficult that it spawned this entire community of really, really hardcore tower defense players, to the point that, and I'm not sure if it was GeoDefense Swarm or GeoDefense, but on the Critical Thought Games forums, they had people that were demanding for him to post the source code on how a particular tower works because they felt that it wasn't applying proper damage when, you know, things are flying by. And just, you know, I can just really appreciate a game that generates a community that's that hardcore.
What was the outcome of that investigation?
I think it actually had some, I don't remember. I want to say it had some kind of bug in it, but it wasn't the bug that they thought it was going to be.
That's pretty impressive reverse engineering by observation.
Is that right, Arnold?
I think the point that the reason he posted the source, he was right for, you know, to show that it worked working properly, but it revealed some sort of fringe case that, that apparently was later fixed.
Now that's what players want right there. That's a gaming experience.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to Randy's picks. So Randy, pick number one, and explain, you know, what the game is in case people.
Sure. Yeah. So my pick number one, and again for me this is a really hard, you know, list to pare down, but I chose I Dig It, and this is by InMotion Software. And David, you actually know the folks in InMotion, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, I worked with a few of them. Jeremy, who was on last week's podcast, and I worked together on the criminal team at Midway most recently.
Cool. So, yeah, I don't know those guys personally, but I really liked their game. I felt like the nature of the game is that you drive this like enormous drilling machine, and you're trying to save the farm by raising up money, and you sort of drill these tunnels down into the ground. And it has a little bit of a Dig Dug, the vintage arcade game Dig Dug feel to it. And you're trying to collect these, you know, different objects you can find underground that are valuable, like minerals and so forth, and bring them back up to the surface to sell them, right? So that it's, you know, a simple concept. But one of the things I liked about it was, you know, first of all, like we've been saying, it wasn't just a standard shoot people to win the game, which so many video games are, especially in the AAA console space. And, you know, looking over the list that everyone is about to share, it's interesting that that's very true for like pretty much everybody's selection. I think that's, you know, kind of a victory for the iPhone that we're able to make games that aren't first person shooters or RTSs or whatever. So I Dig It works on that level for me as well. And the other thing is it's kind of a really nice hybrid game. It's got a little bit of RPG-style character development. You know, you can sort of increase the stats of your vehicle, and you get to decide how to spend your money increasing them. There's, you know, a little bit of exploration where you're kind of, like, examining this underground, you know, sort of labyrinth, for lack of a better word, and you get to build it as you go. So it's also very creative. And the underground terrain was made procedurally. Like every time you play again, it's like shuffled a little bit, and it doesn't make a huge, huge impact on the gameplay. But I'm a big fan of procedural content because I feel like it gives the player a chance to feel like they own the experience a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's got a cool sort of, it's not that actiony, but it's got like a pretty cool resource management thing where you've got gas and you might overheat and you can only see so far, and you can, like, you know, you can ruin the armor on your digger. And so there's a lot of kind of things to keep track of. You know, it's got like an overall quest that you can eventually succeed at, you know, it's got kind of like an arc to it. And the further you go down underground, the more different types of things you can find. So it just really had a lot of thought that went into it. And also succeeded on a production quality level for me. You know, I don't think they like threw every single thing, you know, including the kitchen sink, into their game. Like, I think they're pretty selective and conscious about what things to put in. But everything they did put in, I thought was pretty polished. You know, I think the animations for the digger, for example, are really expressive in a cool way. And so it just felt like a game that, you know, I really appreciated that. I felt like they wanted players to have a good experience, you know, that they weren't in it just for themselves. And I really enjoyed playing the game. It was like, you know, one of the ways I picked from this list was that it's like one of the games when I open my iPhone and I've got like 5 minutes to spare, what's worth 5 minutes of my time? And sadly, that's not always an easy game to find on your iPhone. But I Dig It's one that I came back to repeatedly. So I think that was a success for them.
Yeah. Did you play Expeditions much, or have you?
You know, I haven't yet. Yeah.
Oh, man, it's really good. If you like the first one, it's even better.
Awesome.
It's really, really good.
Cool. Well, you just made a sale with my iPhone.
There you go. Yeah, what drives me nuts about those games is I'm like obsessive about like clear cutting everything when I'm mining. And I actually posted a screenshot of what my level looked like at the end, and it was just like completely open. Everything.
Man, keep you away from my alien planet. Just saw Avatar last night, by the way.
Did you guys? I haven't seen it, so
don't talk about it. Don't talk about it.
Yeah, I agree.
Too soon. My big problem with I Dig It, I think it's a really cool game, and I'm really happy for those guys that they're doing really well with it. My big problem is the virtual joystick. I'm on like a personal mission to abolish virtual joysticks from all games for all time.
David's our assassin.
I just sort of feel like it takes up a lot of screen real estate and doesn't really like it could work just as well if you were touching in the direction that you wanted the digger to go. So I always feel like there's this weird level of indirection when you have this virtual joystick on screen.
Yeah, no, right. Could it work with just swipe controls or something like that?
Although we were talking recently about how, you know, come as a surprise that we were so impressed with. Did you guys play Pac-Man CE?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, Pac-Man CE, they've implemented this dual D-pad. And weren't you impressed with that, Arnold?
Yeah, no, the dualness of it actually.
Yeah, if it was one D-pad, one digital pad, it you know, that's one thing. But the two, somehow you get into a groove of using, you know, both thumbs, and so that kind of gave me a new lease on life, hope, etc. for you know what can happen with a virtual stick. And
yeah, though I guess Pac-Man has a unique, you know, lack of button requirement that a lot of other
that's true too.
So you can waste your other thumb using a separate D-pad, but
yep, that's true.
I kind of was able to give I Dig It a pass on the virtual D-pad thing because it was so well designed into the art style and interface of the game. I thought it just looked cool enough that I didn't really mind that it was hogging up so much of the screen.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of trouble with virtual pads, but for whatever reason, I didn't for I Dig It. Like, it seemed to work pretty well. And, yeah, they made it fun, you know. Like, that's part of the production, you know, quality polish and pass that I was talking about.
All right, moving on to Randy's number two pick.
So my number two pick was Crayon Physics Deluxe. I think it's called it does have the term deluxe on the end, right, for the iPhone version. There's an earlier version of this game called Crayon Physics without the deluxe, but I think on the iPhone we get the deluxe. So, and this is actually made by a guy I know who's a great guy named Petri Puro, and the name of his company is Clooney Games. And you know, it's a little bit, if anyone has played Scribblenauts, you know, it's got a similar concept, although it came long before Scribblenauts. It's like you have to collect a star on each level, and it's kind of got a very strong sense of open-endedness about how you go about collecting the star. But it's very different than Scribblenauts in a lot of other ways. Like, most notably, to get the star, you have to draw physical objects with your finger. And I mean, the pure magic of this game is no matter what you draw, it, like, you know, I'm going to put this in air quotes, but it, like, comes to life, you know. If you draw a weird oblong shape, it'll close itself off and behave realistically as a 2D object of that shape would behave if 2D existed in real life, which it doesn't. But anyway, you know, and there's a few other features. You can make little hinges and stuff like that. But it's also got this wonderful art style where it looks like you're drawing with crayon. And I think the thing that's there's a lot of things that are very impressive about this game to me. I think it's an extremely creative game. It really just puts a lot of trust in the player to decide how they want to solve problems, if they want to do something really interesting and creative, or if they want to try to find the fastest solution or the most brute force solution, or see how many times in a row they can just make a really, you know, big seesaw thing and drop a huge boulder on one end or whatever, like it's, or draw a ramp or whatever. It's like totally up to the player how they want to solve the problems most of the time. I just really love the fact that, you know, somebody finally made a game where you draw things and those things like have a sense of really physically existing. And there's I think there's a real magic to Crayon Physics. And I think the port over to iPhone, because, you know, there was a previous version that existed on sort of like touchpad-y style PCs. I think the port over to iPhone went pretty well. And so it's just a rare game that you just get to pick up and draw stuff and try to solve puzzles however you want. And it looks fun and it's really great.
Yep. David, David, did you have thoughts?
I actually didn't play it.
Blake, Eli?
I liked it, but I like all physics games, so I'm kind of a bad person to critique a game like this because they're all great.
I played it a little, I think, back when it came out. And I've played other games that, you know, there's not, I mean, Crayon Physics has its own sort of, you know, I think it was definitely unique in its the way it handled the hinges and the physical objects. My only issue with, not just with Crayon Physics and with all these sort of open-endedness of the games is that I did sort of, and maybe I'm just not creative enough, but I tended to like get frustrated or maybe brute force my way a little too much, if that makes sense, and not feel like I was doing it the proper way or...
you know, there's plenty of design critiques I could bring to bear against Crayon Physics. And in fact, the guy, Petri, who I mentioned it, would have like 10 times as many critiques because he's very critical of his own work. And yeah, you know, the one of the problems is it's so open-ended that it doesn't really give you a lot of guidance about how you should play. And it has a hard time sort of like leading you to some of the coolest things that you can do.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Scribble Knots has that same problem. Like, mm-hmm. you know, eventually you're just like jetpack, shrink gun, go, you know, or whatever.
Right. So,
No, but I'm a disciplined player, so I always I always try to like, be creative. You know?
No, and that the whole genre of these physics games, I mean, are really popular, and it's just not one that I particularly have been a huge gotten into myself. But yeah, no, the Crayon Physics was really.
What are the competitors? Would you say?
I mean, there's other sort of touch physics games that and I guess I mean Jelly Car sort of as well. Yep.
Jelly Car is a DC, or Ragdoll Plaster is another example.
Yeah, so there's sort of where like. Where you're given this like scene and you need to either draw or do something to it, and for whatever reason there none of them even Jelly Car I never got into.
Wow, just wow.
Eli disagrees with that. Stan. But anyway.
So Eli, you like Jelly Car, but not so much Crayon Physics.
Well, I would say they're kind of two games that are hard to really. Compare together. My issue with Crayon Physics was I felt like either my finger was too fat or the precision required to draw was not what I wanted it to be, I guess. So because of that, it got kind of annoying to play a little bit. I still liked it, but I don't know.
Nah, I'm shedding a single tear. I'm just kidding. Cool. Right. Am I done? Can I drink now?
Hey. Right. So let's move on to Blake's picks. And Blake, why don't you again remember just describe the game in case no one's played it.
Yeah, okay, let's see, what do I have there? I guess I can start with Seuss's, which is a 2D sort of a stylized, very basic, cartoony I guess platformer from Touch Fu. And gravity plays an interesting role. Basically, your character that's walking along planets, a series of spheres, planets, moon type things. You're trying to pick up. You've got little. You're trying to collect stars. You're trying to pick up little companion people, and ultimately make your way to an exit gate. And the art. The background art is quite interesting. It's actually, you know, the different phases that you go through in the game have very impressive. It's not really what you'd traditionally imagine as graphics for a platformer, but they're sort of charming, I think, is the word. And the simple audio tracks, although they do get a little bit repetitive, but they kind of add to that atmosphere. But anyway. So basically, you're moving left, right with the tap to the left, to the right, over on the bottom left, and then you're able to jump with your right thumb. And one of the I mentioned gravity plays a big role. When you're close, you know, when there are two planet objects close to each other, you can jump from one up onto the other. And when you make that transition, the world basically turns around. It flips. So basically. Where his feet, you know, the bottom, the ground, is where his feet are pointed, and depending on how you negotiate these different planet objects, that determines what the orientation is, and it gets kind of tricky. I think in a previous at some point, Arnold, we'd been discussing it, and you were talking about, you know, it's kind of interesting how you have to just kind of jump just right as you move around some of these shapes, and they're not all spheres. There are some land objects that are oblong and irregular shapes and, you know, horseshoe shapes. And it really – you kind of have to – it really kind of puts your mind to the test as far as, you know, spatially imagining, you know, if I just go just a few pixels more in this direction, rounding a corner, what's going to happen when I jump? You know, because it's going to drastically change where you land, and it's just an interesting dynamic, I think.
I mean, that's not to say it's a difficult game.
No, it's not a difficult game, but I'm just saying the underlying dynamic, and I think we talked about it on our first podcast, and I likened it to some of the Super Mario Galaxy shifts when you jump from planet to planet, and it is kind of reminiscent of that, but it's an interesting game, but it's not right. It has an interesting mechanic, but it's not a difficult game. And really, the word I think is charming. Does that make sense? Does anyone agree with me on that?
I think the game is actually kind of difficult as you go, but not because of the physics. I think the physics work as you expect, and that you can jump off platforms and sort of fall where you want to. But
right.
So I don't think the gimmick of it doesn't get in the way of the enjoyment of the game, I guess.
No. Well, the thing that makes it difficult, I mean, as you progress, I mean, some of what you've got to do to get where you need to go, it's just tricky. You know, it's not immediately, and that's nice.
You know? Did you ever get to the end? I never actually finished it because
I've not gotten to the end. I've played hours and hours. This is one of those that was just really when I'm not playing games for reviews, I'm not trying to keep up with what's happening in the App Store just for fun. When I'm on my public commute, I'd pull this out. For weeks I was playing this, and I haven't finished it, but it was I spent many hours with it. And
I think I got to World 6, and I'm afraid I might have wiped it before I was able to. So I might have to start over if I really want to get through it.
I might be in about there in 5 or 6. But
I really enjoyed the game, too. I definitely feel like it deserves for an iPhone game to be amongst the top. For 2009, I mean, because it's an original game, it's got an interesting mechanic that works really well. Controls work really well. I think the level design in the end really helped sell it for me in terms of, the levels stayed interesting throughout, and they weren't just like, a lot of thought seemed like they were put into the level designs, even as you went along.
It's the second purchase I've made as a consequence of this conversation.
It's getting expensive.
It's another testament to the success of the iPhone. It's like, oh, we're having a conversation. I bought two games.
Yeah.
I know, it looks really good.
Yeah.
It's kind of thing like I saw, it came. I think there were some hints, as it was coming out. It came out. There wasn't a lot of. I didn't experience a great deal of fanfare. There was some news up front, but when I played it, I was just really surprised at how good it was. Without having, I guess, personally heard more, and the more I played, it really never got repetitive. I mean, the music got a little repetitive, but it never got repetitive. And it's still one of the games that I haven't finished it, and it'll occur to me. Like, actually, it's funny. I was getting on the bus coming home like 2 weeks ago from the office, and I was sitting there just flipping through to try to find something to play, and it just struck me. I was like, oh my God, it's been like a month, and I just totally forgot that Susie's was on my phone. And I felt like I'd missed out. I was like, oh, man, I've missed out on that. And, it was all upset. I was like, I got to play that because somehow it slipped my mind. And so that's kind of a nice experience as far as, indicating a game being kind of worthwhile.
It's funny you say that because I sort of think that they made a big mistake naming the game Seuss's and not really being able to brand their game a little bit more strongly. Like, the main character to me seems kind of strangely anonymous and for me, the style didn't really work. Like, something about it maybe just felt a little cartoony in a way that wasn't appealing to me. I actually felt physically disoriented playing the game. Like, I think there's just something about the camera. I don't know if I remember reading on the Touch Arcade forums that there were some other people who were kind of feeling a little off when they play it. So I couldn't get hurt.
There was one person, at least one person.
Didn't Natalia comment on our first podcast about that?
That's why I don't really like the game too much.
I think she really liked it. I think she just wasn't very good at it.
Right.
But I read one review of Seuss's that the reviewer said that they were got physically ill playing it. Yeah. Obviously it wasn't a very in-depth review, but
they
recommended it. Kind of a lot of cutscenes before you start playing. I'm like, is the text done yet? Isn't this an iPhone game?
Randy's vomit in a minute. But there's a light version in case you're motion sensitive. You can try. All right. But I really like the game. I actually found it really great. And as for, definitely iPhone platformers are at least more traditional iPhone platformers kind of rare. So that was one of the better ones.
Certainly the most charming game of the year, I would say.
I wish I could get into this game because you guys just love it. And every time I load it up, I just like, I don't know. I just can't get into it.
I can't get enough of this thing.
So you mentioned you didn't finish. Like how long do you guys think iPhone games should be? Like what's your feeling on that?
40 plus hours with RPG style system, pocket gun references.
I've enjoyed playing it. Just I've got so many things I've got to work through.
It's a long game too.
Yeah, I mean,
the leaderboards.
I'm kind of glad it's still out there. Like I'm glad I haven't finished it yet.
You still have it, yeah. Because Dave and I have pretty strong feelings about how long games should be. I mean, like we never. Like I'll speak for myself. Like I never finish games, and I would like to. You know, I would like to be done Fallout 3 after 20 hours and have more hours left to play if I want. And I don't think I'm ever going to finish it at 200 or 300 hours, whatever it is, you know.
I finished in 15, but I didn't do any side quests.
Yeah, I've been playing it for 20 hours and I have yet to, you know, nice. Get to my first major quest point. But that's probably indicative of my playstyle.
I think there's you know, especially for some, you know, I think a lot of it depends on the game, of course, because in terms of replayability anyway, in terms of whether you'd go back and play it again. But there's definitely, a point of which, I guess there's like the threshold of, you know, is it long enough? Because, and part of that also has to do, I think, with the quality of the enjoyment of the game itself. If the game is less enjoyable, I think it has to be longer. Versus if it's a really great short experience, then sure. You know, you're happy even at the, you know, you're just like, psyched about the game even though it leaves you wanting more. So it's a hard thing. I mean, I don't think anyone complained about Spider's Length, did they?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we get, you know, there's two different types of people who complain about it. The kinds who are like, oh, I really love the experience, but I just felt like it was a little too short. I want more levels. And then there are the people who are like, this is ridiculous. I finished this in 45 minutes and I paid $3 for it, you know. So you kind of get some different attitudes toward it. I think those people are kind of marginalized. I think our game is maybe shorter than a lot of games, but... yeah, I mean, our attitude is kind of like, we want you to have a really great experience the first time through. And like, if you want to spend more time with it, there are lots of reasons to kind of jump back in and explore different aspects of it. So,
right. Well, then there's perhaps more replayability on Spider for the experience than, maybe even Asus's type game, which, I guess you can go for more stars or whatever, but
yeah, it's kind of like Ragdoll Physics is very much based on, you know, it's like on the content. You know, you can always replay a Spider level because of the type of systems we have under the hood and have a different experience. You know, and same with I Dig It. It's another one I mentioned that kind of has that quality. But so there's some games that are very much limited in their replayability by how much content there is, and so that's kind of, you know, where Ragdoll Blaster shines, because they have like 700,000 levels now. you know, and maybe Seuss has a problem with that, but it sounds like you played it for a long time. You didn't get to the end, so it sounds hard to complain to me.
Yeah, you know, Seuss, from a content perspective, has plenty of content to the point of like, I mean, you know, you're actually trying to make it through. But you know, I enjoyed the during. And again, we're a little odd audience because we have to move on and play other games,
right?
Because we have to, not because we're necessarily
because we want to.
Necessarily because we're done with the game that we're playing. But moving on, Blake, let's your number two pick, which is on the opposite extreme of you know, the infinite extreme of replayability.
Yeah. The other game is Rogue Touch from Chronosoft, and Rogue Touch, I mean, for me, it's a little bit of a retro and nostalgic appeal, but also there's mostly a general gameplay appeal there that makes me like it. You know, just a little bit of history. Rogue Touch is an iPhone adaptation of Rogue, which is basically, you know, the definitive dungeon crawler. It was developed in the early 80s. It's widely considered to be the first graphical adventure game, so to speak, although it was, you know, it was basically you're looking at dungeons, a screen full of dungeons, which is, you know, rooms connected by corridors. They were originally rendered in text on Unix systems. You would go down a certain number of levels. There'd be a staircase, and you go down, 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 and each consecutive level would have a different layout. I think there was 26 levels?
26 monsters, 26 levels.
Yeah, typically for Rogue, and the goal was to retrieve the Amulet of Yendor at the bottom level and then get back out. Really, roguelikes is a genre now. I mean, there's it spawned a number of games: NetHack, Moria,
Edom.
And actually, you know, even more recently, Diablo was heavily influenced by it, the kind of a isometric graphical piece. Anyway, so basically the thing, I guess it was like a, I don't think it was commercial when it initially came out, but at some point Epic's got the right to it in the early 80s, and they released it in text or ANSI text for the PC. Right now it's basically available on every platform, but they released it initially for the PC, I think, and they released a version that was very appealing, and it was for the 16-bit Atari ST and the Amiga, but the ST was the development lead on that, and it came out about 85, 86, and that was, I think, the first big commercial success of the game, and it had a really nice graphical tile set. I remember I got it for Christmas one year. I guess it was 86 for the Atari ST, and I just spent hours playing this game. And what Kronosoft did was they took the tile set from the ST version. And I've always thought, I mean, I've looked at many, many different versions, many different tile sets on many different platforms, and I always liked the Atari ST version best. They took that tile set with the same color palette, and they've enhanced it a little bit because the iPhone is, you know, rather, it's higher resolution than the ST screen, and they've kind of fleshed it out a little bit, keeping the same colors, and so it really feels to me like I'm playing that ST version, but an improved rendition. And you know, there's a lot of you know, the game came out initially. The developer has been very active in the forums, has been responding. I think there's been three or four updates, responding to user criticism, and he's just added a lot of stuff. It's really, I think it's really one of the very best versions of Rogue. It may be the best version of Rogue out there. And the nice thing is, you know, you can carry it around in your pocket. And basically, you know, you've just got, like I said, you've got these, you've got rooms connected by corridors. You move around by tapping, and the, you know, you've got an avatar on the screen. You know, you pick what sort of character he is, kind of D&D style. And then you tap to move the character in this direction, that direction. You can pick up potions, weapons, you equip them. You can, you know, as you go deeper in the dungeons, things get more difficult. You're going to need to use these potions to defend yourself. You're going to need to equip these different weapons. Go ahead.
So so you wouldn't put Fargoyle ahead of Sword of Fargoyle ahead of Rogue Touch?
I was going to get to that. Sword of Fargoyle is a recently released, you know, roguelike, and it's although the original version was long ago released, and this is a nice update by the original author. But I think Fargoyle is more approachable for the general player, and it has a lot of nice graphical touches, and it's an excellent game. But you know, as a fan of the kind of roguelikes, even back when they were text-based, I actually do prefer Rogue Touch. I guess I'm sort of, having played so many of them, I guess I might be somewhat of a purist, I guess, in the roguelike. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. I'm a purist, and so I don't. No, I really enjoy Fargoyle, but I will say that, you know, I actually do enjoy Rogue Touch more. But for most listeners out there, probably they would, if you're not a roguelike fan in particular, you'd probably get more out of Fargoyle. But for the hardcore people, and there are plenty, you know, Rogue Touches. I think, Eli, you pointed out, it was like, this is one of the, you know, absolute always on your phone.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Their games, right?
I mean, I think that they're both worth having. I mean, if you buy Rogue Touch, you can pick up Fargoyle and vice versa.
Oh, I agree, and you know, it's not like you play one or the other. I mean, they're kind of different enough that they're both enjoyable. Really, for me, I mean, in a way, I'm kind of skewed because, like, you know, looking like that ST game, it feels like I'm still sitting there, like at Christmas '86, you know, playing this game, you know, playing these games, like all amazed by how much fun it was. So definitely, and I'm a retro, you know, maniac anyway, so I've got that tie-in. But they're both excellent games. He's done a great job. There's a couple of other roguelikes out there in the App Store. They don't really, you know, I don't think that they stand up to this.
Yeah, they're not worth mentioning, probably.
Oh, yeah.
No, I wasn't going to get into it by name. But But definitely, yeah. You know, Rogue Touch is just looking at from the initial release to where the developer's taken it with these updates, and recently he's indicated, I think, that there's, you know, there's another update that's going to come. It's just impressive what you get for, you know, for the money. And what is that? I can't remember what it costs. It's probably like a $1.99 or $2.99.
I thought it was free. I
don't remember. Rogue Touch is $2.99, isn't it? Oh,
yeah. $2.99. Okay, yeah. But at any rate, it's just an excellent game. And what were you saying, Arnold?
I was just going to move on. Randy, were you a Rogue guy?
Yeah. You know, Blake, I was very impressed by your obvious devotion to Rogue, and I come from the same background.
Impressed, not bored.
I'm a little worried, Blake, that you're not going to make any converts to our religious move with that speech, though, because you know, it's Rogue kind of inspires that kind of devotion in people, but I also think it's like a really high barrier to entry game because it's you know, it's old school, so it's got very simple graphics. It's you know, turn based. It's not like actiony. And a lot of the play for Rogue occurs sort of on the systemic level. It's like, you know, the other thing, it's based around learning the game systems through death. Like, it's a dangerous dungeon. You're going to die over and over and over before you start learning some lessons about what an ice monster means or when you should drink potions that you haven't identified yet.
Right,
or
that's true.
When the certain types of traps will appear that are going to rust your armor and what that means for you and what kind of, you know, what kind of foils against rusted armor you can prepare, you know? And so it's a really difficult, really fussy, not very rewarding really game on a lot of levels. And so it's hard for people to get into it. But either if you found it early in gaming before those things matter to you,
right.
Or if you can somehow, and I don't know if this is possible, if you can somehow get over that barrier to entry and enter into the religion with Blake and I, you might find a like really like the deepest experience in gaming. Like, Rogue is way up in my list of all-time favorite games because the game is so sophisticated and so deep on the systemic level. There's so many different things that can happen, and the player completely owns the experience.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, we've got a we have a Arnold and I have a common college friend that would be Chris Arnold, who, you know, has tales of, you know, in the dorm playing just like a day of Moria, you know, which is a Rogue derivative, just getting totally sucked in. And I think it's what was it? Eli made a point about, you know, it basically recently, it's not like you might once or twice win, but it's really not even about, like, it's just about how well you do before you die.
Right. Edge Magazine actually like interviewed the guys who made Rogue recently, which is a fascinating read if you're, you know, part of the religion. And it turns out like only 5-ish people have won the game that they know of.
Really?
Yeah, so there's another barrier to entry issue.
I won Moria once.
Cool.
I swear I did, but I don't know. Maybe I didn't. I might.
Well, like the rest of the group seems to have crickets to say, so I don't know.
I always looked at the game. The point of the game was dying in the most fantastic way possible, right. Not necessarily beating the dungeon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's part of it. That's kind of like that's almost necessarily happens every time.
Randy, had you given a sort of Fargo a try?
But I almost, you know, I got it loaded up on the App Store. I'm thinking about buying it.
You won't regret it if you like Rogue games.
Yeah, again, I'll echo again that, you know, we talked about how, you know, it's kind of, it's like a little, Rogue is a little hard to get into, and it's sort of hardcore. But definitely Fargoal is, you know, it's got depth of play. I mean, it's not shallow in play at all. You know, it's got a lot of depth of play, but just somehow it's just a lot more approachable. And so I think, you know, anyone listening who thinks, oh, this sounds interesting,
definitely need a gateway drug.
Yeah, I mean, take a look at Rogue Touch, but certainly I think if you haven't had any time with these things, you know, Fargoal might be a better way to get into it. And
David, how do you feel about Rogue Touch?
Oh, I couldn't stand it. But, you know, Randy and I, we talk about classic RPGs a lot because we both have roots in that stuff, and we're both like really massive Ultima fans. And I think it's just that I never played Rogue when I was a kid. So having not had that experience with it when I was younger, when I played Rogue Touch, I was just sort of baffled by it. But I've been curious about Fargoal because it does look like a more, I don't know, it looks like a more modern update. And I don't know, I'm curious at the $5 price point.
Yeah, I wasn't a Rogue Rogue player really, and I played Rogue Touch, and I think you know, at least compared to a lot of the games that I think we've talked about, where we commented about how natural an iPhone experience they are. Rogue Touch is not that experience. It feels like a port, which right. is fine if you know the game, but if you've never played it and you're expecting an iPhone-like experience, you're going to be sort of disappointed.
But I think, Arnold, as I recall, you were impressed with the game.
I like the game more than I thought I would. I've played Rogue versions in the past, like a little. I never really sat down, but I've definitely, like, I know mm-hmm. roughly what they're about. But yeah, the gameplay itself was more, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. The actual mechanics of the game were a little, for an iPhone game, were a little rough, especially compared to a lot of these other games that we're talking about.
Well, like I said, it's available on basically any platform. I actually saw a video of it being played on a camera, so you ought to try to play it on a camera and see how you like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the game that logged the most hours on my iPhone in 2009. I just didn't put it on my list because it came out in 1985. So
yeah, nice. Okay, well, all right. Yeah. Anyway,
Eli, you're up.
Oh man. Well, I just wanted to go back to what Randy said. I think this was kind of a hard decision for me because I have so much good stuff on my phone, but when I unlock my phone, it's always what's worth, the few minutes of my time that I have to actually like play something that I want to play instead of something that we're looking at for the site or, something like that. So the two games that I've been spending the most time with for pretty much since they came out, the first one is Cannibalt, which is kind of controversial on our forums, but it's an extremely simple game. It's one of those great games like Doodle Jump where you're in the game playing and under, it probably takes less than 10 seconds to load. There's no extra menus or anything else. You just load up, hit play, and you're running along, jumping on top of buildings by tapping, and there's all kinds of different obstacles for you to jump across, and the whole game has this amazing atmosphere to it. If you run about 5,000 meters in, you start, instead of just seeing like the aliens in the background that are attacking stuff, you start seeing this like District 9 looking mothership, and the new update adds online leaderboards and additional obstacles and just made a great game even better. And I've clocked so many hours into that game, and it's just absolutely unbelievable to me at this point. And I have friends of mine in real life that are the same way, where it's just, they have something in the game that is extraordinarily addictive. And I don't like using the word addictive to describe games because it seems so cliche, but I can't stop playing this game.
Randy, David, either of you have thoughts about Cannibalt?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, so first of all, it's a one touch, one button game. That's amazing. Right. How much, it's a, testament to the sophistication of their simulations and how well the game is designed that you can get so much play out of one button. I think the art style is really like retro, cool, edgy, and the game has like an intense urgency. Like it kind of feels like if you're not there playing it, something bad is going to happen. Just because there's so much crazy stuff going on, and you have this superhuman character and all this other stuff. I think it was really a great accomplishment. David,
yeah, I also think it's really cool. I've only played the Flash version. It actually reminds me a lot of this game that. Called like Chopper or something. It's a Flash game. And it's shown up on the iPhone. I know there's a game called iCopter that kind of has the same sort of thing where you basically just, you're holding down a button to make the chopper go up and you release it to make it go down. And there's just like these obstacles, but it's a very like dull, it's a very repetitive kind of simulation. Whereas Cannibalt has this, like this vibe of intensity and awesomeness. And, even though it's like this really simple game where you just have to kind of get locked in to this, to the rhythm of the game, it's a very rhythmic game. You kind of have to be aware and like have your finger like right on the screen at all times and be like completely locked in to succeed at it. It's just got like this really great spirit. And, so yeah, I think it's pretty cool. Haven't gotten totally addicted. So,
yeah, it sounds like you guys got a lot farther than I even realized was possible.
Well, the stupid scoring system now. I mean, I used to think I was pretty good at the game, but loading it up now, it's like, man, I'm never going to beat these people in a million years.
How far have people gotten?
Like over 10,000. I want to say the top one is like close to 20,000, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
All right. Number two.
Number two would have to be Hookchamp, and Hookchamp is the combination of a lot of things that I've really found myself liking on the iPhone. I really like all these retro games or games that have retro art styles to them, because I mean, I kind of grew up playing the, you know, old Nintendo games, so the these kind of pixel art graphics always appeal to me because of that. And I've also really liked a lot of these swinging games, like recently released Rope Raider, I think was the one, and then the Rope and Fly, the Spider-Man kind of game. Is that the right title for it? Anyone know?
That's right.
And I thought those were really fun, but I always kind of got bored of them because they were just kind of a see how far you can go game. And I realized that it's kind of silly for me to say that's why I got bored of them when I was just saying how much I loved Cannonball, which is exactly what you do in that game. But I felt like I was always failing in those games because you just get to a point where it's just too hard to continue on. And maybe I'm just bad at them. But anyway, in Hookchamp, you can upgrade absolutely everything your character can do as you're swinging through these caves. And has a very Indiana Jones kind of feel to it, where you're the start of each level, you're grabbing this idol and then you swing through a cave trying to get away from this ghost who eats you and spits you out his bones. So, you know, you can upgrade your rope, how far your rope flies, the grappling hook, which I think affects how fast it attaches to the ceiling. You get rocket boots, a shotgun, all kinds of different, like, hats, which do nothing but make your dude look cool. And the game also has this really great online leaderboard system all built in that is just a totally seamless experience. And the community behind it is totally hardcore, and you're never going to beat any of the scores unless you're really good at it. But it's still pretty cool how it all works.
Had you played Hookchamp?
I did play Hookchamp, and I liked it. And I think I like it because it also makes an attempt to do something that's, you know, that's native for the platform. And as we've talked about, I'm kind of a sucker for games that, you know, really try to use the touch screen in an intelligent way. Mm-hmm. I think it felt a little repetitive to me in the first half hour or so. And I realized that there was, you know, a lot of depth and, you know, the presence of the store and the ability to kind of, you know, upgrade your character and all this stuff seemed to offer a bunch of longevity that I didn't really fully explore myself.
Yeah, that seems to be actually a common complaint among some people, not naming names, that like they don't really understand the complexity of the game when they first load it up, because you play, you know, the first little level and you're like, well, this is, you know, this is a swinging game except I'm collecting coins.
Yeah, I think that they put a lot of sophisticated design into their level design and their power-ups, but they didn't advertise it that well to the player, so it's hard to know why your decisions matter or what the layout of this level is, and so why it's important that you miss that, like, top path instead of the bottom path and stuff. I had a lot of trouble with that, and I replayed it a bunch to try to figure out what was going on, you know, sort of in a design analytical research capacity.
Yeah, and, you know, although I admire the fact that the controls are native, I also found them a little bit kind of hard to understand immediately. Like, there was something indirect about the way that the kind of the rope, the hook thing would kind of project out of you. Like, I almost wanted to be swiping or drawing the line or something, but it kind of requires you to touch. And then I never could quite figure out how the thing was going to go relative to my touch.
Yeah, so Blake's the one who, and he made a step away for a minute, but Blake's the one who I think was a little lukewarm about the game when he first played it, and then I think that was right during our podcast on it, and then now he's like, it's one of his top games for the year, so it sounds like there does take a little time before you really get it.
Well, yeah. I think the whole experience would be a lot better if there was some kind of like really basic tutorial in the game where you go through a very simple level and then it like shows you the store and explains like what the different items do, because I think there are a lot of people that get lost on it, and that's totally a valid criticism for the game.
Yeah. I wonder if we should have like a level preview mode where you can kind of like fly through with just the camera and see what the level's going to be like, you know, so it'd help have you. Yeah, but in general, I thought it was a really good game. I feel like I shouldn't be nitpicking it.
I also think some of it is that the you know, you, as your equipment upgrades, the control sort of gets better too.
Yeah,
the feel gets a lot better. So and I think that's a common, you know, issue or whatever in certain games. I think Need for Speed Shift, like the early cars are kind of slow, and then Ridge Racer also, I think the first cars were pretty slow, and eliminate the controls when you first play, or like, you know, you feel like you're moving in slow motion because, you know, you have the bad equipment, right?
Right.
And then, but once you get up.
Is that why I couldn't play Eliminate?
Yeah. Well, that might be one reason, but definitely, Eliminate, you feel like you're like tiptoeing around when you first, you know, when you're at like level zero. And then, you know, as you get like better armor, you know, it feels more like you, you know, versus like when you're playing Doom or like, or whatever, you know, that where you're at like the optimal speed.
But yeah, similarly, design challenge to like raise the stakes and also like empower the player over time without that meaning that they start with extremely low stakes and completely disempowered. You know, it's a hard design problem. So.
Yeah. But I think that is discouraging. I think so. Blake's back. So he can comment about how, I don't know if Blake, did you hear, we're talking about Hookchamp. One of the comments I made was the early, when you first start, you have like the worst equipment. So the gameplay is a little, doesn't feel as well as it does later on as you upgrade your equipment. And I don't know if that was a factor in you not liking it as much on day one than you do now.
Yeah, I think, you know, I played it a decent amount, but I had the basic, when you start with the basic equipment, right, it doesn't feel like it, I guess you would want it to, or it should. You know, I think I had done a couple of upgrades, but I hadn't gotten far. At this point, you know, I've gotten to the point where I've upgraded all the key components to the max, and it does feel just like you want it to feel. And yeah, it, you know, once you kind of get to that point, it was quite a while ago in the gameplay that I'd maxed out the hook, you know, the shotgun, the you know, whatever the other key components are, but you know, and I've played well on since then, but it's just a lot better experience since then. It doesn't take that long to be able to get enough you know, credits or money to do the upgrades, so and I will say that I do, you know, now that I've gone farther and upgraded to the full, you know, I'm much more fond of the game, so it is another one, one of the few that I do now for fun, actually, interestingly, play. So, which is not a common thing. But
yeah. All right.
Hey, Blake. Have you ever heard of Spelunky?
I am aware. I haven't.
It's kind of a rogue-like game, but it's got the same sort of like 8-bit graphics, Indiana Jones style platformer thing that Hookchamp has going on.
Okay.
Really? It's made by this guy Derek Yu, and so I'm sort of on a mission to get Derek to port it to the iPhone. So
really, I've heard of it. I haven't played vibes,
that'd be great.
Okay, interesting. I'll have to look into that.
All right. So moving on to my list of games, which I've narrowed down to two. So the first game that I chose was Sway by Illusion Labs, and this came out, you know, first half of the year, and was really just, I mean, in terms of what, when we talk about games that are really suited for the iPhone or feel like they're, you know, iPhone specific, I think Sway was that. So basically it's sort of a platformer, but really you're like a monkey or a ninja, you know, there's different characters, but basically you're a monkey that's swinging from left to right on this on these sort of walls that are hanging in the air. So it's more of a traditional platformer goal where you're picking up stars, trying to get to the end of the level, and you need to avoid obstacles, jump gaps, and basically you know, make good time. So the controls are interesting and may actually be ultimately what prevented the game from being a huge success. I'm not sure in the end how their sales did, but I know initially it sort of didn't take off really right away. And because there's a learning curve to the controls. It's a multi-touch game where you left side of the screen is one arm, right side of the screen is the other arm. When you tap, you're holding on and you're supposed to swing. And you're supposed to get into a rhythm where you swing sort of with one finger, then the other, and then back and forth. The problem is if you don't swing right or you let go, then you pretty much fall to your death. And there is a bit of a learning curve, I think. And even I think the initial, after playing it a fair amount, you know, fair amount being, you know, a day or two, I still wasn't near as good as I ultimately became when I actually spent a little more time with it. And but I really enjoyed the game. I thought the level designs were great. I thought it was just a great original idea, very good use of multi-touch on the iPhone. It was probably a little on the short side, and one of the critiques I had was that you could sort of brute force your way through it once you got good enough. But then, you know, you do. There are sort of time goals that make you want to play faster and better. So I'm not sure if Sway was kind of early, was one of the earlier games. I'm not sure. Did you get a chance to play Sway?
I did play it, and I couldn't get into it. I had a lot of trouble with that control scheme, actually, and it was, again, one of these games that stylistically kind of hit the wrong note for me. Like, I didn't really understand what the, like, frog-like character I was playing was supposed to be. So, yeah, I don't know. I struggled with it a little bit, but I appreciate its iPhone-native qualities.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely the control. I mean, I was frustrated. You definitely get frustrated with controls initially because you keep falling. And it takes some practice before you can figure them out. Randy, did you ever try it?
Yeah, I tried it. And, you know, Illusion Labs, the company that made Sway, also made Touch Grind, which is, of course, you know, a really great finger skateboarding-based game on the iPhone, native to the iPhone. And I think this company has their heart in the right place in tons of ways, and I think they're really successful and great. And I think Touch Grind really shows a lot of that. But in both games, I think they do give a little bit too much over to their physics simulation. Like, it's kind of their strength and their weakness, is that they just really put the game in the physics simulation and don't do a whole lot to temper it. And so therefore you kind of need to understand how the swaying monkey or frog or whatever works to be able to play Sway. And anything you do wrong means, you know, as you guys have been saying, is like a really punishing, you know, conclusion to the game. And I was constantly stuck in some bizarre corner of the board in Sway and not able to get my monkey frog back up higher to collect the stars, and my little arms were flailing around and he looked really upset. And so I had trouble getting into it. I put a lot of effort into getting into it though, because I did trust the company, and I still do. And I think it was, you know, a great idea. Yeah.
Mm. Well, so, you know, it's no Rogue in terms of whatnot.
Busted. Yeah.
Eli, I don't actually know if I know your opinion on Sway.
Well, I was I like Sway, but I kind of ruined it for myself because I figured out how to, like, cheese the game, because you can just, like, swing your dude around really fast and then just fly across.
Swing him all
the
way to the end of the level. Yeah.
I tried that, but I fell the wrong direction.
I got really good at cheesing the game, and once I got good at that, it was like I couldn't go back to playing how you were supposed to play, because it just seemed way too hard, as opposed to just, like, flinging the guy to the end.
I think they put obstacles in late in a later update.
I haven't played it since initial release. So, but other than that, I mean, it was before I figured out how to cheat in the game. It was a lot of fun.
Like,
yeah, well, I think it's one of the best examples of the multi-touch on the iPhone, and I found it extremely enjoyable. You know, the whole physics of the you know, the monkey or frog thing. It's great, you know, like, as you, whether you're cheating, you know, doing that long fling, which does take some skill, or whether you're playing it normally and picking up the various, you know, items as you go along, you know, it's just quite enjoyable. And my biggest criticism was, indeed, it seems rather short play experience. I mean, it was definitely, I remember being rather disappointed when I finished it, because, you know, then you'd already done it, and it was enjoyable. I mean, I've gone back and played it over a couple of times through, it is definitely one of my favorite iPhone games. And again, this is another one I pointed out to my sister, who I was introducing to the platform. That was like one of the top three that I
really. See, I'd be curious how your sister liked it as more of a casual.
Well, I think she, well, when she played it,
she's not talking to Blake anymore.
Right. Well, I think basically I showed it to her, and she spent a few minutes while we were eating dinner
falling.
You know, playing it. Yeah. And basically, I think in her opinion, the game is about a dropping monkey or frog.
Yeah. Like
that's all it was. So I don't think she really got on board with it. But then again, she's not nearly as dexterous and nimble as I.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know.
So ultimately, the skill level, and you know, the reason that, and I may have, and eventually I got really good at Sway, which is why I, and I don't know if you guys saw, there was a video I recorded of, like, getting gold on Sway, and so you can become really good at it, but again, the learning curve is a little steep, but I'll send you guys a video so you can you know, see it, that, you know, people, you can't actually, you, there is some skill, I guess, once you get there, but.
Yeah, and I think that's to his credit, right? Like, it's cool that you can actually have, like, very hardcore skill-based games on the iPhone. I think Illusion Labs is one of the sources of such games, and that's what they do well.
Mm-hmm. All right. So my second game that is on my list, and it was a tough choice, of course, like everyone said, you know, Ice Laying Down to 2. But I had to give credit to Flight Control. And I know people... Flight Control sort of been so ubiquitous lately with all the clones and whatnot that I feel like people like kind of hear it and go, oh, it's Flight Control. You know, everyone knows what Flight Control is. But I mean, I think a lot of credit has to be given to the game and to, you know, Fireman's for basically creating this new, you know, genre of game for the iPhone. I mean, it came out in, I think, March or so. And I remember it, you know, seeing it and thinking, oh, you know, it looks okay. It doesn't look very, you know, exciting. And then playing it and then really getting into it. And then, you know, obviously that experience was shared by, you know, a ton of people. I think it's sold over a million copies now.
There's all kinds of celebrities playing it too.
Yeah.
Ashton Kutcher.
Right. Right. And it's, I mean, and it really was a great game. And I, you know, I'm not playing it these days so much, but again, my, my game playing, you know, all of our game playing, like, experience a little different than the regular customer, but you know, I put a lot of hours into Flight Control early on, and you know, it spawned a whole category of games ever since. And you know, there's a lot of things it did right, especially for being such a simple game. And I'm sorry I didn't explain what the game was, and it's in case no one's played.
Someone who hasn't heard of it at this point,
right? So it's, you know, you get airplanes on it, and there's an airfield, and you're supposed to touch and draw a line, a path from each airplane to land properly, and you have to avoid collisions. And, you know, there's three, I think, or there used to be three different types of planes, and each of them run at a little different speed. So you can't really stack them all in a row because one will catch up and crash into the other one. And, you know, the thing that I think was so awesome about it was that you, it got so crazy at one point where there's so many planes and you feel like you can get those planes on the ground, but then you kind of lose your attention somewhere and then one of them crashes into each other and you're like, oh, you know, if I just looked over there, I had just done the right thing. So Flight Control was great. I loved it when it came out. I still love it. I just haven't played it lately because of being so busy with other games, but and it's obviously, it spawned like this whole category of game on the iPhone. And I think in terms of iPhone games, you know, Flight Control is very much an iPhone game.
Their online scoring system is also like one of the best, I think.
Right. You can tag.
It's,
you can have,
it's
tags.
Totally overlooked too.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, you can compare with people like in your neighborhood, right? Like they have like a location-based leaderboard set up. It's really,
really
cool.
Well done.
Right. And people can tag themselves. It's like Touch Arcade. So you can see how you compare to other people who tag themselves as Touch Arcade, that sort of thing. So yeah, no, it's really well done, especially to avoid the, you know, people, you know, not so you're not just competing with that guy who did 10,000 or whatever on Flight Control. It's just such an iPhone game. Like, you know, it was born on the iPhone, and it exists only because the iPhone exists in many ways. But and you guys have any other thoughts, David?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hugely impressive to be able to basically like spawn a genre, and not only that, but basically make your game that spawned the genre better than almost all of the things that followed it and tried to imitate it. I have to say that I think I did enjoy Harbor Master a little bit more. I think it's just kind of like a refinement of the original concept in many ways. Just from an overall, like, you know, the Flight Control as a piece of software, like the entire game experience is just really smooth and accessible, and you can jump right in and everybody gets the high concept, and the art is really appealing. And I think ultimately I kind of want to like this type of game a little bit more than I actually do, because I get frustrated with insta-death, and, you know, I sort of wish that there was, you know, some variation where, you know, you could crash a couple times or regain, you know, health or something so that you could kind of continue playing. You know, I would just, you know, I would feel like I was getting into a groove and then just make one mistake. You know, and it also kind of feel like I felt like maybe it didn't have the longevity. I mean, I think that maybe why people aren't talking about it as much now, even though it's probably one of the most brilliant games to come out this year for the iPhone. After a while, I think it just starts to feel like you're spinning plates. And unless you get really good at it and you really feel like you want to master it and get a high score on the leaderboards, like there's kind of a limit to where you can go with the basic mechanics.
I agree with that, because it seems like I plateaued at most of those line drawing games and just kind of lost interest when I, you know, could only do as good as I was able to do.
Yeah, it's because the games are so unforgiving. It's like, I really think what Fire Emblem made isn't so much a game as a game mechanic. Like, from now on in the future of the iPhone, there's this thing called you can draw a line to tell the character where to go. Right. And man, there's a lot of stuff you can do with that. And it's almost unfortunate that most of the games have the same characteristic, that one mistake means the game is over. Like, that's not particularly imaginative cloning. Like, we shouldn't be cloning that game. We should be taking that mechanic and putting in other cool games, you know? So I'm excited to see where that mechanic goes, and, you know, hats off to Fireman for coming up with something so fresh and so powerful.
Yeah. Blake, did you ever get into flight control? I don't remember.
Yeah, no, I did. I quite enjoyed it. I don't think I was ever as skilled as you at the game based on your reporting of your scores. but no, I did quite enjoy it. Yeah, it just the big thing about it is it seemed at first glance like, you know, so simple and, you know, maybe not that interesting, but it was just so addictive and just a simple formula and it worked great for the platform, and like you said, you know, it definitely inspired a genre, and that's pretty impressive stuff. And
so it'd be interesting, and I think two things came. David, you had mentioned, you know, saying that it was a bit simple, which leads to the question of whether or not Fire Emblem will do a flight control too. I mean, I think that'll be interesting. I don't know the answer to that. And you know, I think sequels are a little I don't know, on first glance seem a little lame to like, but you know, you could see them taking it a lot further. And you know, I think name recognition has a ton. I think we saw with GeoDefense, it's a sequel. They did really well on day one with their sequel. I presume from the strength of the original. And, yeah, you know, so.
Well, if something like Rope and Fly can sequel itself and do well with the sequel, I think they'd be crazy not to do it at some point. But they obviously are passionate about other things, and I think they seem like a really cool developer. And it sounded like Flight Control was kind of this side project for them, like somebody kind of conceptualized it on the weekend. And, you know, their passion was more on real racing. You know, they wanted to do, like, the really big, like, class of iPhone 3D racing game, which I assume they accomplished. I'm not a big racing fan.
And then Randy mentioned about using the mechanic in other games, and I think that we've seen a couple of games that have tried. And I think there was one actually that was really interesting, I thought, though ultimately the game was a little hard to I couldn't get into the, it didn't have enough depth, but there was one where you're controlling players around and shooting like against, like, so you're controlling
33rd Division, right?
No. 33rd Division was a little different. But
it was a stealth game. That was pretty good too.
That was a stealth game, but similar. You had to sort of you had to avoid. It was a little different, I guess. But there's one that you're actually like controlling these artillery guys that were shooting. You know, these enemies that were trying to attack your base. But what's interesting about that is you would draw like a circle around like the enemy, and so you'd do like these sort of maneuvers, like shooting like. Basically, like circle strafing, almost like these enemies. But
cool. How did it work?
It worked well. It does. The screen seemed too small to really do much to be able.
Oh, Boom Brigade is what you're talking
Boom
about.
Boom Brigade, yeah. The screen was too small. I felt to actually. I mean, it was a great concept, and when I started playing, I thought, "Oh, this is great. I love, you know, I love that like you can like send your guy like to do a full semicircle around like while you're still shooting towards the center of the pack." But right, the iPhone screen so small, it was hard to do much beyond that, and so you kind of felt like you're limited. I mean, it's still a fun game, but not as fun as I would have hoped. But again, interesting with the line drawing concept. Okay, so I think that, unless anyone else, any thoughts about any other games that they failed to mention
from my huge list?
But I think that covered a pretty good sampling of the games. I think.
Yeah, so are you guys going to be doing like a big best of 2009 feature?
I think we are. We're gonna try to. There's not much left. Not much time left in 2009, so we got to get it out. But I think this will help, and we'll have to go, tediously go through basically every review we did this year and try to figure out which we consider the best.
Cool. I look forward to it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for being on. And you guys want to talk about? Just give us your website and your information real quick again, so you can people can
sure.
know where to find
well,
you.
Well, you know, first I'd like to say it was really great, chatting with you guys, and Dave and I both go to Touch Arcade all the time as one of our first sources to see what games are coming out and what's good out there. And I've been watching you guys in your ratings over the internet. It sounds like you had an awesome year, and you guys are like rising to the top of the pack of iPhone game coverage sites. So congratulations to you guys.
Oh yeah, thank you.
Thanks. All right.
And yeah, we're Tiger Style. We made Spider the Secret of Bryce Manor, and there's a brand new Director's Cut update that just came out a couple days ago, and also Spider Hornet Smash, which is a fun, free, sort of mini game based on some Spider stuff. You can find us on the internet at tigerstylegames.com, and thanks a lot for your time.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It's really awesome.
Great. Cool.
Thank you.
Well, that's been another episode of the Touch Arcade podcast. Everyone have a happy holidays. And as always, leave a comment on our front page, post on our forums, or shoot us an email if you have any comments, questions, concerns, etc. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.